Coming up, humanitarian groups trying to address the worst refugee crisis since World War II. My report from the border between Turkey and Syria. And Saul Gonzalez looks at the Mosaic Church in Hollywood, ministering to young adults, millennials.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome. I'm Kim Lawton, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. Religious leaders around the country renewed calls for more dialogue about race issues after several high-profile incidents this week. Tensions ratcheted up again in Ferguson, Missouri, after two police officers were shot as demonstrators gathered in front of the police department. Local clergy appealed for calm. People of faith were part of vigils and rallies in Oklahoma over a fraternity video with racist chants, and also in Madison, Wisconsin, where an unarmed black teen was shot by a white policeman. All of this took place as the nation marked the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday in Selma, Alabama, when state troopers attacked civil rights marchers. Many religious leaders took part in a series of events to commemorate that and subsequent marches, which led to passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. The U.S. Supreme Court has ordered a federal appeals court to reconsider its ruling against the University of Notre Dame in a case about birth control. Last year, the lower court said Notre Dame must comply with a requirement under the Affordable Care Act to provide contraceptive coverage for its employees. The Supreme Court said that decision should be re-examined in light of its ruling last year in a case involving Hobby Lobby. There, the justices allowed closely held for-profit corporations to receive religious exemptions from the contraception mandate. Many faith-based groups are seeking the same right. Middle East religious leaders once again appealed for international help as ISIS continued its assault against Christian and Assyrian villages in northern Iraq. Militants have been destroying ancient sites, including some mentioned in the Bible. The U.S. Catholic bishops urged Americans to pray for the marginalized and persecuted. In a new report, the bishops also raised concerns about the huge numbers of refugees generated by rising ISIS violence and the ongoing civil war in Syria. They said the situation has reached a tipping point. This month, Syria's civil war entered its fifth year. More than 20 international aid groups released a statement saying the world community has failed in its efforts to deal with the humanitarian crisis. According to the United Nations, more than 220,000 people have been killed and 1 million wounded since the conflict began. Nearly 4 million Syrians, about 20% of the pre-war population, have registered as refugees in neighboring countries, which are being overwhelmed by the burden. Many of those refugees, more than 1.6 million of them, have ended up in Turkey. Recently, I traveled to the border between Turkey and Syria to report on the challenges facing the refugees and how people of many faiths are trying to help. Southeastern Turkey shares a 500-mile-long border with Syria. On this day, the view into Syria looks quiet, peaceful even. But just a few miles from here, Syrian government forces, rebel groups, and ISIS are waging a brutal battle for control. So far, nearly 1.6 million Syrians have sought safety in Turkey, and more are coming every day.
They escaped from this conflict with their own clothes. They couldn't bring any kind of stuff, their belongings together with them. They just escaped. They left everything behind.
Since the beginning of Syria's civil war in March 2011, nearly 11 million people have been forced to flee from their homes. Almost 8 million are displaced inside Syria, while 3.25 million have ended up in neighboring countries. Daryl Grisgraber focuses on the Middle East for the advocacy group Refugees International.
We're really talking huge numbers of people at this point, about fully half the population of pre-war Syria, needing humanitarian assistance and really being dependent upon that. It's just been very hard to keep up with both the needs and the numbers.
Savaş Maten is General Secretary of Kimseyokmu, a Turkish non-governmental aid organization that's part of a civic movement started by Islamic scholar Fethullah Gulen. The group works in 113 countries around the world and is also helping in the burgeoning refugee crisis in Turkey.
I put myself into their place. I will be in the same situation. I will be the one who escaped from the war, from this conflict. And they came here, and you know, Turkish hospitality. They came to our country, and it is our duty to help them.
Here in the southeastern city of Kilis, just on the border with Syria, officials say there are more than 100,000 Syrian refugees. That far outnumbers the local population.
Kimseyokmu sponsors a refugee feeding program here that distributes 4,000 meals every day except Friday. People wait in line, sometimes for hours, to have their buckets filled with food for their families. Kimseyokmu volunteer director Mehmet Demir says many of the refugees had middle-class lives in Syria, but are now forced to survive on charity.
There is definitely a need for food. If we didn't need it, they tell us, we wouldn't be waiting here.
Right at the border crossing in Kilis is a government-run camp for Syrian refugees, or guests, as the Turks prefer to call them. Some 40,000 Syrians live in two government-run camps in Kilis, but the camps are full.
About three-quarters or more of the population in Turkey of the Syrian refugees are not in the camps at all. They're what we call urban refugees, so they're living in host communities. Maybe they have friends and family who are helping take care of them, but many of them have to rent hotels or rent apartments. And if you don't have money for that, you pitch a tent in a public park or you live in an abandoned building.
In addition to its feeding program, Kimseyokmu distributes boxes of food, blankets, and other supplies to these urban refugees. This man, his wife, and their small daughters live in one room of a house where five other refugee families have also rented rooms. They came to Kilis a year and a half ago.
He said, you don't know when the bomb will come to your house and kill you and kill your family. So that was a problem for me. So I came from there to here.
Many of the refugees can't find work. The demand for housing has driven up rent prices, so people are paying large amounts of money for small spaces that are ill-prepared for winter. Sabah's family, including her five children, live in this drafty shed, which floods every time it rains. Her husband can't find a job. She says she doesn't want to go back to Syria, even after the war is over. She says with all the bombing, there's nothing to go back to. Hussein and his family came here last year after his home and business in Aleppo were destroyed by bombs. He has a job making office furniture, but says it's not enough to support his eight family members, including baby Fatima, who was born 6 months ago in Turkey. Kimseyokmu has continued working with Syrian refugees despite recent political differences between the Turkish government and some of the group's supporters. Many Kimseyokmu volunteers say they're motivated to help by their Islamic beliefs.
This is showing our religious side, as in the saying from the Prophet Muhammad. He who sleeps on a full stomach while his neighbor is hungry is not one of us.
Mehmet Sarıkoğlu with the U.S.-based Rumi Forum believes such work ultimately helps make the world a better place.
We need to do something to alleviate those problems for the people who are suffering. Throughout the world, wherever we see people who are crying and asking for help, it is incumbent on us and everyone to alleviate those problems, regardless of religious, cultural, ethnic, racial backgrounds.
While most of the urban refugees are in border areas, more and more are making their way to other parts of Turkey, especially to big cities like Istanbul. At the Roman Catholic Holy Spirit Cathedral, Spanish-born Salesian Father Andres Calleja Ruiz leads special programs for refugee children and youth from Syria, as well as a growing number whose families are fleeing ISIS persecution in Iraq. Because the children don't speak Turkish, it's difficult for them to attend local schools.
We teach them English, of course, but also mathematics, geography, and sports, music, dancing. To make them to feel that they are children, like any other children, and to liberate themselves a little bit from their traumas, and above all, to open their eyes and their heart to a future.
Most, but not all, of these children come from Christian families. Church leaders in Iraq and Syria are urging them to consider coming back to repopulate ancient Christian communities that have been decimated by the violence.
They are very much concerned because practically Christianity is like bound to disappear in this region. And they are concerned because it was born here, Christianity. And after 2,000 years of Christian life with churches, with monasteries, with crosses everywhere, it seems that now, all of a sudden, this is becoming part of history.
Many of the refugee families stay in Istanbul only a short time before moving on. While they're here, Father Andres says the mission of the church is to create an environment of love where religious and ethnic affiliations don't matter.
Syrian and Iraqi children playing together, they don't mind. Muslims and Christians alike, they don't mind. They make a big family.
Although Turkey and the other neighboring countries initially welcomed the flood of refugees, the sustained crisis is taking its toll. In some areas, tensions have been rising between refugees and locals.
You can imagine having an extra million people puts a strain on local markets and the ability to get food, on the employment market, the labor market, for example, on the water resources, on the sanitation systems, on the infrastructure like roads, on hospitals. And so all of the host communities are definitely feeling the strain and have been asking for help for quite some time.
Donations to humanitarian groups haven't been keeping pace with the needs. So far, Turkey has limited the number of permits to international non-governmental aid organizations that are working with refugees in other countries, preferring to handle the crisis internally. That may have to change, as there's no sign of things letting up anytime soon for Turkey or any of the host countries. Chris Graber says the international community needs to work harder for peace.
There needs to be a political solution to the crisis, right? Because in the end, no matter what we do with humanitarian work, it's just a Band-Aid. The best humanitarian work in the world is just a Band-Aid. The outflow of people and people being pushed into needing humanitarian assistance just needs to stop.
In the meantime, despite the challenges, many say there is a moral imperative to keep trying to help. In other news, an American missionary with the Free Methodist Church who was kidnapped in central Nigeria has been released unharmed. 71-year-old Phyllis Sorter was abducted last month by an unidentified group of captors. Free Methodist officials declined to say whether or not a ransom was paid for her release. Chinese government-appointed officials in Tibet this week accused the Dalai Lama of, quote, profaning Buddhism by suggesting he may not be reincarnated after he dies. Tibetan Buddhism holds that the soul of a deceased senior lama is reincarnated into the body of a child. But the 79-year-old Dalai Lama has said his spiritual lineage may end if Tibet isn't free from Chinese rule. China's communist government maintains that it should have the right to approve any successor to the Dalai Lama and other top Tibetan Buddhist leaders. We have a story now from Saul Gonzalez about the Mosaic Church in Hollywood, California. It's designed and run to appeal to young adults who have no ties with traditional religion, but who are deeply interested in finding meaning for their lives. The Mosaic Church has become a model for other efforts around the nation.
Visit Hollywood Boulevard at night, and this is what you probably expect to see. City lights and glittering marquees, and crowds looking for a bit of Tinseltown glamour. And just steps from all the tourist attractions, there's this place. With its DJ blasting electronic dance music on stage and its young and very hip crowd moving to the beat, you might think this is a trendy Hollywood nightclub. But this is Mosaic Church, a Christian house of worship that focuses on ministering to the millennial generation. These are men and women born in the 1980s and 90s and who came of age in the first years of the 21st century.
Young crowd? Really young. Again, average age is about 26 years old. Maybe 75% of them are single, maybe 80% are single, so it's a hugely single community. The bulk of our community is probably between the age of 20 and 34.
Erwin McManus is Mosaic Church's founder and pastor, and a man who spent his religious career connecting faith to young adults, many of whom grew up with no strong religious beliefs. But McManus says they're searching for a deeper meaning for their lives.
You have a generation that's saying we're tapping out of religion in many ways. But what they're not saying is we're tapping out of a serious search for meaning in life. They're not tapping out of a deep spirituality. In fact, if anything, there's an incredible and profound hunger in millennials saying, if there's something beyond this life, I want to connect to it.
Most Americans in their 20s still describe themselves as religious. But according to a poll by the Pew Research Center and Religion and Ethics News Weekly, 1 in 3 millennials has no affiliation with any house of worship. But that doesn't rule out their embrace of religious beliefs and practices. Experts say the millennials just want to come to faith on their own terms.
Millennials, if you had to sum them up in a word, you'd sum them up in terms of choice. Millennials are the most interested in choice. They see it as their American right. So,
and that includes faith.
Absolutely, that includes faith. There are a lot of millennials who are involved in...
Bree Lascota is managing director for the Center for Religion and Civic Culture at the University of Southern California. She says millennials, especially those in urban areas, often reject strict religious classifications and are more likely than their parents or grandparents did to customize their spiritual identities by drawing from a variety of faiths.
You see new forms of hybridity. So I'm a Jubu, I'm a Jewish Buddhist, I'm a Budeo-Christian, right? Some of my favorite ones. These kind of mashups of religious identity that are really unique. People look at that and think, oh, they are so individualistic that all religion will fall. And I actually think there's a more interesting question, which is how is religion being reconstituted in the 21st century that doesn't look like it looked in 1950?
Lascota says Mosaic Church and other houses of worship like it represent that new face of 21st century American faith, with their youth-friendly emphasis on self-expression and creating a sense of community in a relaxed, even party atmosphere. At Mosaic, that atmosphere often includes potluck meals outside the church and playing games before worship services begin. It's those kind of things that attracted 24-year-old James David to Mosaic. He's an aspiring singer who often uses his talents to perform on Mosaic stage.
I can say, like, for me, whenever I set foot in a church, I want to feel like I belong, and I want to feel that I am welcomed and that I am seen, especially being in your 20s. Like, that's what you want anywhere you go. So for me, the cool thing is going to a church where I feel seen and loved and appreciated, and I'm having a conversation with someone versus someone's talking to me or at me.
Mosaic also attracts people who've lost touch with their own family's religious traditions.
It's the first time that I come to a church like this. The language here is very unique. It's very easy to digest.
Fabiana Braga, who grew up Catholic in Brazil, says she feels much more comfortable in this environment, both because of her fellow parishioners and the tone set by Pastor McManus.
Talks about freedom. There's a lot of young people who comes here. The pastor is amazing. The environment is amazing. You meet a lot of interesting people. And it's the first time that I connected spirituality with art. I've never seen anything like that. And this is so cool.
As he bounds on stage for worship service and greets his congregation, both those sitting in the auditorium and watching on the web, the stylish McManus looks like he could be hosting a television talent show like American Idol. His sermons often focus on how millennials should reject the values of their elders, especially if those values clash with their own ideals.
You should absolutely refuse to allow yourself to keep ushering in the old world. And you know when you allow the old world to steal from you the new world, when you choose bitterness, when you choose greed, when you choose anger and hatred and racism, when we choose to be less, we drag the old world with us, which is sort of tragic since we are the creators of the new.
But as they search for meaning, McManus also acknowledges that millennials, like those in his congregation, have been shaped by materialism, pop culture, and technology like no other previous generation. Even as he preaches, it's easy to spot people in the congregation busily texting and checking their social media feeds on their smartphones. McManus says faith must increasingly compete with these distractions head on, and he thinks one of the best ways to do it is by making religion entertaining, like what happens at Mosaic.
Isn't that a part of the problem? Is that we have equated the sacred with the mundane, or the spiritual with the monotonous. And so when people say, well, aren't you just entertaining them? I go, wait a minute. The word entertain means to hold someone's attention. And what we want is we want a faith that's vibrant and alive and beautiful and real.
But critics of houses of worship like Mosaic say they too often sacrifice traditional beliefs and moral instruction in favor of creating a fun environment. They also argue that pastors like McManus downplay their positions on controversial social issues, such as abortion and same-sex marriage, for fear of alienating their young, often more socially progressive congregants. In our conversation with him, McManus acknowledged that he often does steer clear of divisive issues like gay marriage.
Yeah, I see. I don't ever come out and go, I'm pro same-sex marriage or I'm against same-sex marriage. What we want to do is love everyone. Our job is not to change people. Our job is to connect people to Jesus. It's Jesus' job to change people.
Culture war issues still do matter, but they matter much less than they did previously.
USC's Bree Lascota says that if they want to prosper in the coming years and decades, American houses of worship will need to adapt to the millennials' views on faith and culture, views that she says likely won't change much as the millennials grow older.
If I were in a congregation or in a denomination, say in the Christian tradition, that thought that millennials will eventually just get it and come around, that would be a big signaler for me to be worried, because I don't think that millennials are going to change. I don't think that they're going to end up looking just like boomers. And I think that if you have institutions that are unwilling to meet them where they are and to help them experiment with religiosity in ways that bring new life into institutions and then also help them anchor themselves in a tradition, if you're unwilling to go down that path with millennials, you should be worried. If that doesn't happen, then congregations will cease to be congregations and they'll become museums.
So is Mosaic Church a preview of things to come in American religious culture? That's unknown. But certainly one thing this place isn't is a museum. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Saul Gonzalez in Los Angeles.
Two prominent American pastors died this past week. United Methodist pastor Fred Craddock was one of the nation's best-known preachers. He taught preaching at Emory's Candler School of Theology until his retirement in 1994. He was 86 years old. And Reverend Willie T. Barrow, a key leader in the civil rights movement, died on Thursday at the age of 90. She was the first woman to lead PUSH, a Chicago-based organization for racial justice. The winner of this year's Templeton Prize for affirming life's spiritual dimension is 86-year-old Roman Catholic layman Jean Vanier. He founded L'Arche, an international network of communities for people with developmental disabilities. In 2006, Judy Valente spoke with Vanier about his ministry.
How are you, Ray?
These are the people Jean Vanier calls his friends, people he describes as pushed aside with broken hearts, people, he says, who have transformed him.
My life is to live with them, to be with those who are fragile, vulnerable, and weak. I'm not sure that we can really understand the message of Jesus if we haven't listened to the weak.
Yeah, he's my one man and one man only. I love this man.
The son of a French-Canadian diplomat, Vanier served in the British Royal Navy during World War II. Then he taught philosophy in France. He has never married. For a time, he considered the priesthood. But in 1964, he found his calling, opening the first L'Arche home in a small village south of Paris.
Through all this suffering and pain and fatigue, at the same time, we are seeing incredibly beautiful things. That's to say, people who are transformed, and we are beginning to sense that we ourselves are transformed.
You can watch the full story on our website. By the way, this year's prize is valued at nearly $1.7 million. Vanier plans on giving it to his charities. Finally, on our calendar, Pope Francis marked the two-year anniversary of his election this week. And as many observers use the occasion to assess his papacy so far, one thing is for sure, his popularity continues to rise. According to a Pew Research Center survey, 90% of U.S. Catholics have favorable views of Pope Francis, as do 70% of Americans of all faiths. That's our program for now. I'm Kim Lawton. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and I'd love to connect with you there as well at Kim Lawton on Religion and Ethics Newsweekly. Watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's always much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more scenes from the first 2 years of Francis's papacy.
Care familie, benedicat vos omnipotens Deus, Pater et Filius et Spiritus Sanctus.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics Newsweekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.